Hello and welcome to Health Fact versus Fiction, brought to you by HCA Healthcare UK. I'm Anna Richardson, and this is the podcast where we uncover the truths and bust the myths about your health with some of the country's leading consultants. It's something we tend not to talk about, but a huge amount of people will suffer from tummy troubles of one kind or another at some point in their lives. So on this episode, we're talking bowels and how to keep them healthy. With me today are two consultant colorectal surgeons who will hopefully help us understand how our movements work. We have got Colin Elton and Darren Francis, who both work at HCA Healthcare UK's Wellington Hospital. Boys, hello.
Bonjour.
Ciao.
I love you two already. Let's start, as we always do on Health Fact versus Fiction, by busting some myths. Because I imagine that when it comes to your bum and your bowels, there are many. So are you ready, boys? Can you tell me whether the following statements are health fact or health fiction? Number one, constipation is only something I'm going to get when I'm older.
That's a difficult one, because it's neither fact nor fiction. It's a bit of both.
Tell yes. me.
Women and elderly are much more commonly affected, but there's a much more increasing amount of children that are developing constipation as well. 10% of women under 65 years of age in the UK have constipation, but over 65, double, 20%.
Do you know what I loved about your answer there is you started off by saying, constipation, it's a difficult one. Thank you for that.
That's right.
So, Darren, the next question. If I have an itch in my bottom, that's definitely hemorrhoids. Fact or fiction, please?
Fiction. Definitely fiction.
Do you know what? I'm going to talk about this in a
you
bit.
You could have stood on the fence there, but you just went straight for it.
Fiction.
Straight fiction. Okay, and Colin, back to you. If I change my lifestyle, I can reduce my risk of bowel cancer. Fact or fiction?
That is fact.
Okay, thank you.
That's
we
right.
will get more into all of those things later on. But first of all, Colin, yes. if I can start with you, we know that a vast amount of people do suffer with gastrointestinal problems. Around 40% of the population have at least one digestive symptom at any one time. So why is it that we just don't talk about this?
Well, I think it depends which country you live in. I think the French love to talk about their bottoms. But actually, for some reason, the British, we just like to keep our head in the sand, bury our head, just like the ostrich. We don't like to talk about it. I mean, if you go and look on television, you see so many adverts about this or that, but nobody wants to touch the anus.
Nobody wants to talk about it.
I'll tell you absolutely.
What, I was chatting with my mum only yesterday, and she was watching TV, and she said in her day, if she sat watching TV with her dad, my mum's 75, and if her father was watching a programme and it showed an advert on toilet paper, he'd look away and go, oh, how can they possibly show that? So that just shows how times have changed.
So we are peculiarly British, aren't
Absolutely.
We? Sort of peculiarly uptight about talking about anything sort of bottom related. Do you think that, well, I suppose I'm answering my own question here. So really, we don't pay enough attention to our bowel movements. Is that right, would you say?
I think we do. I think we're obsessive, but we don't share that information with everyone. No one talks about it, and that's the main issue. When patients come in to me and they say they've got a bit of a problem with their bottom, I don't know whether the same happens with you, Colin, and they say they've got a pimple or a tag on it, if everyone looked at each other's bottoms, everyone sees wrinkles in each other's faces, but they don't see wrinkles in their bottom. A baby's got a perfect bottom. When you get a bit older, you get tags, you get bits, you get bobs, and you just don't share that information. We don't talk about it.
What does your poo say about you? I mean, is it true that really, you know, you are what you eat?
Yeah, it's not like tea leaves. You're not going to be able to see the future through your poo.
But Colin, what should the perfect poo look like?
Well, there is actually a stool chart. It's the Bristol stool chart. But I don't think everybody should be mad now and Google that and actually say, that's the picture of my poo. I wonder if that's good or bad. I don't think it matters. I think that as long as you're opening your bowels regularly and you don't have any symptoms such as pain in your bottom, you don't have any discomfort in your tummy, I don't think it matters. And I don't think people should be worried too much about the, you know, the actual shape of it, that it's got to be a particular shape. The only thing about that is that we deal, both of us, Darren, don't we, a lot with patients who have bowel cancer. Mm. And one of the things that is concerning is when you have a change, and sometimes it can be a change in the consistency of what the bowel motion looks like, whether it's smaller, whether it's sometimes a different shape, whether it's looser, whether it's harder, that sort of thing. So that's important. But I think as a general thing, I wouldn't want people to be worried about it.
Okay, so Darren, what are the biggest factors that influence bowel health, would you say?
There are so many factors that influence bowel health, but the most important factor is probably your diet. Okay, when you're not talking about processes, genetic processes, processes we can't help. If you want a good, healthy bowel, you have a good, healthy diet. What goes in comes out. It's as easy and as basic as that.
So what for you, and when you're treating your patients, constitutes a good, healthy diet? What do you advise?
Not too much red meat, lots of fibre, lots of fruit and vegetables. Just the common, I think everyone knows in this day and age, because it's advertised so well, the 5-a-day rule. All basic things like that. If you have a good diet, then you'll have a good bowel. However, that's not the be-all and end-all. And what Colin alluded to earlier was the change in expectation. Mm. You've always got to manage. People expect that you go to the toilet once a day, every day. Mm. That's not what everyone does. It's the change. So if everyone has always gone every other day, or even every 3 days, or twice a day, that's what the norm is for them. So that is a healthy bowel for them, and whatever they're doing right. They don't necessarily have to change that, okay? If it's interfering with their quality of life, then they might have to address their diet to become more comfortable. And as Colin said, if they're getting pains, aches, problems, and of course blood, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later, that's a different kettle of fish.
So Darren, you've touched on a good diet, but Colin, does exercise feature as well in terms of keeping your bowel healthy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, keeping yourself a bit more active is a good thing. It's, they say you are what you eat, but also it's with regard to health, healthy in mind, healthy with regard to your bones and your muscles, also with regard to your bowel. And it's important to keep your bowel healthy as well. So yeah, so regular exercise is a very important thing.
Okay, let's talk about some of the most common issues that people experience with their bowel. I think bloating. Bloating is a very common one. What causes bloating?
Interesting. It's a very common symptom. Patients say, oh, my tummy feels bloated after I eat. You know, they're eating too much. It's basically gas. That's what it is. Some people swallow a lot when they, you know, when they talk,
so
when they eat.
So they're swallowing air.
They're swallowing air. So that's what they produce. So also bacteria in your gut will produce air as well. So that's why there's a lot of, you know, people in the health food industry about giving people probiotics aimed at changing, you know, the bacteria within our gut, this sort of healthy bacteria. But generally, it's with regard to air. And particularly with regard to certain foods. And now, we talked about having fibre in the diet. People with a condition called irritable bowel, they get a lot of bloating. Their bowels perhaps don't function as well as others, do they, Darren? And so what happens is that a lot of people would go and say, well, let's have some more fibre. Interestingly, fibre is actually the wrong thing. It irritates the gut. So it's a difficult thing because you have those patients who you want to say, look, you're constipated, you want to increase the fibre, it reduces bowel cancer. But increasing the fibre in certain patients can give them a lot of bloating. So it's a difficult thing. That's why finding the right balance is difficult.
But the word we tend to use for this is irritable bowel.
Yeah.
And most bloating is irritable bowel. Now, irritable bowel is a bit of a cop-out for doctors.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's really a diagnosis we make by excluding other things. And it's saying, well, we can't do anything about it. It's just the way you are. And that's true. There's not a super pill which they come in and the patient will see a specialist and say, here's the pill that will get rid of your irritable bowel. But everything we've alluded to earlier, the lifestyle, the diet, the exercise, decreasing your stress, all of these factors will lead you to decreasing the bloating because it's not normally one factor. It's a multifactorial problem. If you're stressed at work, for me, I don't know about you, Connie, if I had an afternoon exam, and I've done a lot of exams, I'd sit on the toilet all morning. Whereas if I didn't have an afternoon exam, I'd just be normal. That's irritable bowel in its simplest form. But there's other people which have other things going on in their lives which affect them.
Let's talk about excessive wind, shall we, Darren? Why are some people just a lot fartier than others?
OK, well, there's two reasons for that. Some is just what they're eating, OK? And others, they feel they're fartier than others because they can't control their farts. And this is, well, another thing which isn't...
Is this a thing?
Somebody
can't control their farts?
It is a thing. And it's mainly in women that have had natural childbirth. Women that have had children through vaginal deliveries
Darren, I think women would say it's men, actually, to be honest.
Particularly in bed.
No, they could. But there's two problems here. There's one where you're just producing excessive wind, which is normally a dietary thing. And there's the people that find that they can't control their wind, and it's more of the elderly, older population. And once again, it's something which isn't discussed. So I don't know about you, Colin, but patients will come and they'll say, oh, listen, I'm really troubled with it, but it's a normal thing for older women to get if they don't do pelvic floor exercises after childbirth, things like that.
So, Colin, are you telling me that my vagina and my bum are going to collapse?
Well, it all depends upon your pelvic floor.
It's a yes, isn't it?
There's, to some degree. The pelvic floor is a muscle that supports three structures in the pelvis in women. In men, it's two. In women, it's the bladder. In front, in the middle, it's the uterus, and behind, it's the rectum. In the man, it's just in front, it's the bladder, and behind, it's the rectum. So you can imagine, with time, things sag. Also, with regard to pregnancy, pregnancy stretches the pelvis massively and destroys or damages some of the nerves that supply the muscles. So eventually, things sag. So women, unfortunately, will get a bit of what's called stress incontinence. When they cough, they leak a bit. Their vaginas may sag a bit. And unfortunately, a bit of incontinence, fecal incontinence later in life.
But surely, I mean, what can we do about that? Because I'm sort of squeezing as you speak. Surely, rather than advertising ten a lady or ten a man, you know, we should actually be advertising how to improve your pelvic floor.
Absolutely. But it's like, but the thing about that is the patient or the person has to make effort. It's like going to the gym. It's like any other muscle. If you don't want your muscles to become weaker and stay strong, you do exercises. And for a woman, I mean, listen, men have their own problems. It's just that they don't have the same pelvic floor issues because they don't have babies. But if you want to keep those muscles strong, you've got to do exercises.
So let's just talk about the opposite end of that spectrum. That we're discussing people who just can't stop farting. But what if you can't go to the toilet at all? Tell me about constipation. Is it common, Colin?
Yeah. So it is very common, as I alluded to at the beginning. You know, I get referred a lot of children, actually, who are constipated.
Sorry to interrupt. It's funny you should say that, because I was saying to my producer earlier on, I was hospitalised as a child with constipation, and I just refused to go. It wasn't that I couldn't, I refused to go. Yeah. So I think that it was perhaps an emotional thing going on. Tell me about that. That's interesting.
If we go from, because there's different spectrums of reasons for constipation at different points in your life. So as a child, you've got to know that actually going to the toilet is important. So some children just won't go to the toilet at school. They'll think it's an embarrassing thing. This whole thing, again, about, oh, my God, it's a really dirty thing, and then having to go to the toilet and wash your hands. So you find that children actually will not go to a toilet, especially as well. They know that toilet's been used by several hundred children. So that's a real problem.
So what they do is
that they hold themselves in for the whole day until they go home. So there's this whole thing of building up that very bad habit. And the other thing is, hate to say, but it's true, is that we're now in the fast food industry, giving our children absolute rubbish processed food, not concentrating on giving our children fresh food, fruit and veg. And it's a real problem, actually. So one of the things that we try and do is actually re-educate. But it is difficult. It is difficult. And, you know, a lot of parents are angry at schools, as you know, for trying to re-educate their children about what they eat. I mean, my wife was saying to me that at the school where we send our children, one of the parents was really angry with the school for saying, oh, no, you've got too much carbohydrate on that. You've got to have fruit and veg. And said, you can't tell my child. I'm paying for this school. And that's the problem. We've got to try and re-educate.
But I think people also have to take some responsibility for their own health. In this fast lifestyles we live, we want instant response, we want instant gratification, we want things to change, email, Twitter, all of those things. People will come to doctors and say, I'm constipated, make it better.
Yeah, do something about it.
Absolutely. And the person that can do something about it, as Colin says, is the individual. Okay, there's not a tablet. There is, you can take things to soften your stool to help you. But a lot of people, if you have a bottle of Evian by your desk at work and make sure you drink a litre of water a day, that will help. If you make sure you don't eat meat every night of the week and have a salad a couple of nights, that will help. All of these things. But you have to take some responsibility.
That's interesting.
Anna.
Yeah, no, it is about. I love the fact you're saying you have to take some responsibility, Anna. I feel like I'm six again. I'm in hospital. Sorry. Sorry, Darren. Can we talk about itchy bums?
Yes, of course.
Because I think everybody gets an itchy bum.
Yeah,
we do.
And again, given that I'm such a massive health hypochondriac, if I ever get an itchy bum, I immediately think that I've got worms, take myself off to a chemist and worm myself. But even though I haven't got children or anything. But why do you get an itchy bum? What's that all about?
There's many, many reasons for an itchy bum. And essentially, if you start from the outside and work in, OK, the skin, then just inside the skin, then inside the rectum, and just working your way up the bowel. So there's a multitude of reasons. It can just be a skin condition, it can be drugs you're taking, it can be worms, and then working way up the hemorrhoids that you asked first of all, that can leak a bit of mucus, many, many reasons. So don't just put it down to worms. The other thing, of course, and the thing you don't like to mention to patients is anal hygiene. What do you think about anal hygiene, Colin?
How dare
you? Why are you looking at me that way?
No, it's something which is very difficult to broach, a subject. So you can see a patient and essentially the reason they've got an itchy bum is because they're not hygienic enough.
No.
Now, they will think they are, and it's some individuals, the smallest amount of soiling, the smallest amount, will react with the skin around there and make it itchy.
Really?
So they need to rewipe and rewipe more thoroughly.
Okay, well, I'm going to really get into the meat and two veg of this one. So what is good anal hygiene, Colin?
So good anal hygiene is making sure that you're as clean as possible afterwards. I actually tell my patients to use wet wipes, actually. Not the perfumed ones, but the natural ones, the soapy ones. Actually, just to clean themselves, but also not to wipe vigorously. This is bizarre, so we're trying to retrain people how to wipe their bottom. But if you wipe your bottom too vigorously, you take the surface of skin off, and when you do that, the bacteria go underneath and they cause more itching. And the more you do and the more you wipe or scratch, that's why you only get that feeling of, oh, that feels a bit better for a very short while, and then it gets worse again.
But we're not meant to flush wet wipes, are we? So what are you recommending we do?
No, I know that there are a lot of biodegradable wipes, but I don't truly believe that they are completely biodegradable. And therefore, I think it would be sensible just to throw them in your toilet.
What we want to be careful is that the anal hygiene, we're not going to try and preach to people, this is what you have to do. Anal hygiene only becomes an issue if you have an itchy bum. If you don't have an itchy bum, then carry on doing exactly what you're doing because you don't have a problem. There's not a rule to say everyone should wipe their bum this way. It becomes an issue for myself and Colin because people come in with an itchy bum, of which anal hygiene can be one of the causes, and then you have to re-educate them what they're doing. But if you haven't got an itchy bum, just carry on as you are.
So if you have an itchy bum and you have a patient coming in to see you saying, I've got an itchy bum, Darren, then is there a perfect way to be hygienic? Should you be using a wet wipe? What would your advice be?
The advice would be to try something different to what you're initially doing. So there's not a perfect way of wiping, but our advice, as Colin mentioned, would be to try, if you're not using a wet wipe, try a wet wipe. Or, for example, if you're getting itchy, after you've opened your bowels, go back to the toilet half an hour later, three quarters of an hour later, and just rewipe. Because you've got to remember, the people that come to us, the likes of myself and Colin, have got a real quality of life issue with their itchy bum. Mm.
So they're really itchy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they've got to change something. And the sort of suggestions Colin has made is a typical colorectal surgeon's suggestion.
Okay.
And just to mention other things, it may not just be that. They've got to look at other things in their life as well. So what they're eating, try to avoid spicy foods as well. Spicy foods will always make your any itching worse.
Oh, ring sting, classic.
Absolutely. Just making sure also there's no rash there as well. Patients with eczema, as psoriasis.
Can you get it on your bum?
You can get it on your bum, unfortunately, yeah.
What about skin tags? Because I understand that, you know, if you irritate your anus too much, then you can end up with skin tags. Is that right?
So skin tags are more commonly as a result of, let's say, when people strain, they get a sudden rupture of a blood vessel around their bottom and they get a lump and then it just settles by forming a skin tag. Classical one is, again, women in pregnancy who strain, particularly, you know, in childbirth, and they say, oh, they've got hemorrhoids. And usually what they are these little external thrombosed hemorrhoids that then form these little skin tags.
So can you have them removed?
You can. What do you advise, Dan?
Everyone has a personal preference. I was taught by an old mentor of mine that the biggest form of litigation is the smallest operation, and a skin tag is a very straightforward thing. You just chop it off. However, it comes with a consequence. It's blimmin' painful. So you're essentially doing a cosmetic operation, because like we said before, everyone's got tags to a certain degree. However, some people come in and say, this is affecting my quality of life. I don't feel clean. I don't like what it looks like. I don't like what it feels like. Mm. Get rid of it. Mm. And you have to counsel them. And you say to them, listen, I'm happy to do it. It's straightforward. But you will have pain for 2 to 4 weeks. The other thing, of course, Colin, I don't know about you. Do you warn them of them coming back?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's expectation.
And they can come
it?
Back at any place around their bottom.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you're absolutely right. When we talk about consequences of having an operation, they think it's like, oh, putting a little bit of string around a skin tag on your neck.
So sensitive.
Your bum hole
is so sensitive.
It's one of those sensitive. And, if it leaves a wound, it takes about 4 weeks to heal. It can get infected. So it should only be done if it's absolutely
necessary.
I don't
know about you, but in the first 2 weeks after doing any anal surgery, people will phone up almost daily, your sex agent. Yeah. This cannot be right. This is so painful, et cetera, et cetera. We warn them of this. If you get it right, then at 6 weeks, they say it's the best thing I ever did. But those first 2 weeks are blimmin' sore, aren't they? I mean, you've got to warn the patient. Any operation on your bottom is sore. It's such a sensitive area.
And I think we don't consider this enough, do we? That, anybody listening, that if they have a problem, they think, oh, well, I can just go and get it sorted by my surgeon. Yeah, it is a really sensitive area, isn't it? And also, it's an unclean area, so it's at such risk of infection.
Interestingly, God made us in such a way that we very rarely get post-operative infections from that, because you can't possibly keep it clean. You can try and keep it clean. You do get abscesses, you get boils and stuff, but that's normally from something different than an operation. We live in symbiosis. We live at one with our gut flora. And so, unbelievably, it's an area where you don't get post-operative infection.
Really?
That way.
Yeah, we seem to have an unusually innate physical barrier to these things around our bottom, which you think to yourself, there's no way I'm going to keep this clean.
Exactly.
And we do tell patients, actually, to bathe in a warm bath every day, in a salt water bath. But generally, it's uncommon to get an infection.
Gosh, that's extraordinary. Can we just talk about hemorrhoids?
For sure.
Because apparently more than 3/4 of us over the age of 45 are likely to develop piles. Yeah. Why?
Well, let me just first say that it's quite interesting. Whenever somebody mentions about any problem to do with their bottom, they naturally go and say, I've got hemorrhoids, I've got piles. They attribute every single symptom to hemorrhoids. So the first most important thing, and this is a myth, is the fact that you don't have hemorrhoids as a result of problems. We all have hemorrhoids.
Absolutely.
Hemorrhoids are part of... I know that sounds weird.
Hang on.
We all have hemorrhoids. Yeah. Anna, you have hemorrhoids.
Yeah. No, we don't.
Yeah, everyone's got them.
Do.
God's given us them. Whether you call them hemorrhoids or you call them anal cushions is up to you.
So hold on. Let's just define a hemorrhoid. Because in my experience of hemorrhoids, they are really painful, sort of grape-like bloated veins around your bum that knack. So are you telling me that we've all got hemorrhoids?
Yes, those are less likely to be hemorrhoids.
Oh.
Those are more likely to be anal skin tags.
Oh, don't start. Yeah. Not on the tags again. So what is a hemorrhoid? Right, hang on. Right, Darren.
Yeah.
Hemorrhoid, what is it?
So hemorrhoid is when one of your anal cushions, which we all have, starts to bleed or prolapse out of your bottom. So it becomes a hemorrhoid because we've now labelled it a hemorrhoid because it's become a problem, okay? Everyone has these cushions. Now, you could have huge cushions, which when you look at, you could call them a hemorrhoid, a pile, an anal cushion, but they only really become a hemorrhoid when a patient comes in and says, I've got a symptom, I've got bleeding, I've got prolapse, I've got something which comes out my bottom.
And do they hurt?
Classically, they don't. But in certain situations, they do. So most hemorrhoids are painless. They just produce bleeding. When you get a thrombosed hemorrhoid, which means it's come out of your bottom and can't go back in, then they're very, very painful.
This I have experienced. So a thrombosed hemorrhoid, I've ended up with a camera up my bum.
Yeah.
Trying to check out what is going on. Man, it hurts.
What, the camera or the hemorrhoid?
No, the camera was fine. The hemorrhoid, ooh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's a very
But there's a lot of other reasons for anal pain. And in fact, we get more suspicious, Colin. When you take a history and a patient comes in and explains what's going on, if severe pain and bleeding is one of their problems, then it's probably less likely to be a hemorrhoid. It's likely to be other things.
Have you guys ever had a hemorrhoid, Colin?
Well, I think that everybody at some point in their life has had a painful bowel motion.
Yeah. I mean, that,
everybody has.
That goes without saying. So, what do you do to treat yourself? If you're sort of going, oh, God, this is tricky, something's going on. What do you follow your own advice, basically?
I think absolutely. So what you do is you drink more fluids.
Mm.
You make sure that you increase the fibre in your diet. So I'll make sure that I have something adequate so I'm having a soft bowel motion. And then if it still doesn't go away, then use one of the topical ointments that you can buy over the counter. You don't always have to have prescription-based medication. There's loads of ointments that you can just go to your friendly pharmacist and say, by the way, I've got a bit of problem around my bottom. Can I have something to relieve the discomfort?
So just something to lubricate, basically, and just to ease...
It's something that... There's a lot of medications. Some of them are herbal-based. Some of them are medication-based that are just there to reduce the inflammation. That's all it is.
It doesn't cure them. When patients come in and say, I put this over-the-counter medication on, it made me feel a little better, like Colin's saying, it just soothes the pain. It doesn't make the go away. Nature makes it go away. Nature's an amazing thing. I don't think we have enough faith in it. We have more faith in doctors than we have in nature. And Mother Nature, she just sorts things out a lot of the time.
Can we talk about something more serious, which, of course, is bowel cancer? Almost 42,000 people are diagnosed with bowel cancer in the UK every year. So, Colin, what are the symptoms of bowel cancer?
So I think that if you see blood in your poo, I think that you should go and see your doctor. It does depend upon what age you are. Clearly, bowel cancer is more common in the older age group. But if you're aged 40 or over, I don't think you should ignore it. And we're finding even patients younger than that, 30 on and onwards, are starting to have an increased incidence of bowel cancer. But I want to reassure everybody that it's really the group between ages 65 and 75 that are most commonly afflicted with bowel cancer, which is why the bowel cancer screening is from 60 onwards.
What causes bowel cancer? Is it a lifestyle effect or is it a genetic, you know, problem? What causes it?
There's so many factors. Just to talk about genetics, only probably about 5 to 10%. Of all bowel cancers are genetic-based.
Really?
And the rest we call sporadic, as in they've just cropped up out the blue.
Well, in that case, you know, you're answering the question, which is it's mainly lifestyle.
It's mainly environmental, but mainly lifestyle.
But the problem is we don't know which particular lifestyle.
What do you think?
I've got to be honest, Anna, I don't know. I don't know what particular... I think it's the whole global looking after yourself. And then my personality is such that there's a lot of luck involved because we operate on patients with bowel cancer who are the most fit, healthy people. Rather than lifestyle, I think it's awareness now. I think that's more important, Colin. I think if we can pick these patients up at an earlier point and they don't ignore their symptoms and they come and seek medical help earlier, then prevention is better than cure. Because the important thing is that most cancers will start as a polyp.
So bowel cancer potentially starts as a polyp.
A polyp, which is abnormal. By definition, it's a polyp, but it's not a cancer.
Yeah.
And if it's left, it will become a cancer. However, that can take some years. Yeah. And if you go and have a telescope examination, a colonoscopy, because you've got some symptoms, or you enter a screening program, which is to pick up those patients that haven't got symptoms, they're just in an age group, you can pick up these polyps and they can be taken off at the time of the telescope with only a very, very small risk, okay? And then you're clear, you won't get bowel cancer.
I do want to also anybody who does listen to this to go and say, well, actually, it's not just about awareness of their symptoms, but also they can do a few things. I mean, the increased risk of bowel cancer in this country, just like all the other cancers, is just year upon year, more and more people are being diagnosed with bowel cancer. And I know with regard to looking at particular foods, what we're eating much more processed foods. Foods have changed, you know, over the years. So I think it's really important that we do, and I hop back to, do you not agree, eating more fresh foods, eating more fibre, less processed food, less red meat. But the other thing is also not smoking, smoking and alcohol, so drinking alcohol in moderation. And, you know, we're always against smoking for so many different reasons, but also increases the risk of bowel cancer as well.
How effective are the tests that people get through the post from the age of 60 onwards?
So it's quite interesting. Several years ago, they started what's called fecal occult blood, which are these stool tests that people over the age of 60 receive every 2 years. And, you know, I think they're very good. The only problem is that probably about 50% of people actually send back their stool. Again, it's this sort of British attitude. I'm going to ignore that. That's come in the post. I'm not going to do that. And they throw it away. Mm. But actually, it is important because it's the most common test we have. It's a very simple test. Accuracy, probably between about 65 to 75% accuracy, which is reasonable. You can say, well, actually, that's not great, but it's such a simple...
I think that's pretty good.
It's such a simple test to do. There's a newer test coming in, and we were discussing this yesterday, yeah, weren't we, Darren, which is the FIT test, F-I-T. Not to be fit, but it's looking more detailed at the blood that's in your stool. So what a faecal occult blood is trying to identify blood that you cannot see. So it's pointless, I suppose, if you're bleeding every single day because it's going to be positive. But the FIT test looks at blood that you haven't ingested in the food. Mm. So it's looking at your own blood. And you actually only need one stool sample as opposed to the faecal occult blood that you receive, which you have to send six samples, which is a lot.
And that's the crux of it, because these are all good tests, but people don't want to touch their poo. They don't want to put it into a pot. They don't want to send it off. But if we can get people to accept that with a 70% sensitivity of picking up a potential cancer, we need to make the public aware that do the test. It's normal. Everyone do the test, except it's a bit like self-examining your testicles and things like that.
Everyone
has mammographic screening now. It's acceptable. Absolutely. We need to make these poo tests acceptable.
If somebody does get their result back and it is positive for bowel cancer, what's the prognosis like, Darren?
Well, with the point of a screening test, so if they get it's not positive for bowel cancer, it'll be positive for blood. So if we're talking about a screening test, the prognosis is good because you're hoping that you've picked up someone who doesn't have symptoms, and therefore, if they have got a cancer, it's a smallish cancer which hasn't had time to spread or cause problems. So those types of patients, the idea of this screening is to pick it up early so you can do something to cure them.
So it really is worth doing.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. Number one, you could prevent it completely by removing a polyp, which could become a cancer. Or number two, it would be an earlier cancer, which you could remove, perhaps surgically, with hopefully curative intent.
When do you think that we ought to be getting in touch with our GP? At what point, if you have a concern about your bum, should we be seeing our doctor?
I think Colin mentioned it earlier. Bleeding, change in bowel habit, weight loss, abdominal pain. All of it, and not after 24 hours, but we tend to say the guidelines would suggest 6 weeks. But that's a guideline. Any change, if you don't normally bleed and you bleed, you've got to go there. If you have a change in your bowel habit, which is prolonged over 6 weeks, you go and see someone about it. And likewise with abdominal pain.
And Colin, finally to you, what are your top toilet do's and don'ts, please?
Okay, so don't take your iPad into the toilet. Don't take your mobile phone into the toilet. It's not your throne. And it's not your there. So because I've got to get away from the kids, or I've got to get away from my partner. And it's not your chance to read all those magazines that you probably have got behind the toilet. It's your chance to literally just go in, do your business and get out. And also wipe yourself clean, wash your hands afterwards.
One other thing to add, have a look at it as well.
So it's your chance to be at one with your number two.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Colin Elton and Darren Francis, consultant colorectal surgeons at the Wellington Hospital, thank you both very, very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
You can find more information about bowel health in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at hcahealthcare.co.uk/podcast. And while you're there, check out the website to find out more about HCA Healthcare UK's world-class, award-winning private hospitals, specialist clinics and private GP services across London and Manchester. Health, Fact versus Fiction is presented by me, Anna Richardson, and is a Bengo Media production for HCA Healthcare UK.